She sits on the couch in the dark, a lit cigarette between her fingers. The darkness is comforting. It hides the horror, the shame she sometimes feels. But most of all, the darkness is going to help her hide what she has decided now needs to be done. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 174, The Murder of Jaco Engelbrecht. In February, there's something lined up on CBS Justice that all true crime fans will adore. A specially curated Lethal Lovers strand for Valentine's Month, taking viewers deep inside a range of murder investigations, all showing just how far some people will go when love goes wrong. 24 hours a day for 16 days, you can catch a variety of back-to-back episodes from some of your favorite series, including Charmed to Death, Killer Relationships with Faith Jenkins, Lovers Lane Murders, and Snapped, Killer Couples. So immerse yourself from the 1st to the 16th of February on DSTV Channel 170, and a huge thank you to CBS Justice for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you. Are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at True Crime South Africa /donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Chrissia Wells Stoddard, Tisa Rodriguez, Yolanda Faree, Mariska Boyson, Keegster, Mignon Buerta, Blake, Lizette Chamberlain, Naylene van Breda, Korta, and Alta Reineke for your support on Patreon, as well as Pietra Durich for your support on PayPal. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a big difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. Although the line between right and wrong in crime is almost always very clear, there's always the odd case where the line seems faded or uncertain. Well, maybe that's not really accurate. The act of taking someone's life is always wrong. It's always illegal. The legal side has levels, though. And every now and then, a case comes along that may have us questioning whether the moral end does too. Are we ever justified in taking someone else's life? Or are there any circumstances that make it understandable? Those are the questions I ask myself as I was researching today's case. I'm not sure that I personally ever arrived at a firm answer, but as always, I'll just give you the facts and maybe a few ways you can further interrogate those facts in your thinking, and then you can decide for yourself. In researching this case, I used several academic studies, which included excerpts from the court case, as well as a few media articles and an episode of Heiskanoot Ware Levensdramas. So, let's get into episode 174, The Murder of Jaco Engelbrecht.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Annemarie Engelbrecht was born in Carltonville in 1974. She was one of four children born to her parents, and her father was very physically and emotionally abusive. Throughout her childhood, Annemarie was subjected to physical attacks by her father. Her mother was also assaulted regularly by the man. On one occasion, her father beat her so badly with a hosepipe that Annemarie's injuries came to the attention of her teacher at school. The teacher reported the abuse to the police, and Annemarie's father was arrested, charged, and eventually found guilty of assault. Annemarie was removed from the home and put into foster care for a while. But her father was soon back from his short prison stint, and Annemarie was returned to the home. Nothing changed, and if anything, her father became even more abusive. In addition to this, when Annemarie was 9 years old, she and her siblings were home alone together, and they were playing when the young girl accidentally injured her eye with a stick her brother was holding. Although Annemarie was in a lot of pain and bleeding from her eye, the siblings decided to wait for their parents to come home rather than run to a neighbour to get help. I have absolutely no doubt that this decision was influenced by the abuse and control they'd suffered from their father, and the fear that they would get into trouble. Sadly, by the time Annemarie's parents arrived home and they were able to get to the hospital, her eye was beyond repair, and it had to be removed and replaced with a glass eye. This would have a huge effect on the girl's self-image, and she struggled with her confidence throughout her life. As the abuse from her father continued in her life, Annemarie would later recall how her mother had always thought that she was doing the right thing by staying with the man, as she thought that was what was best for the children. After the beatings, her mother would gather Annemarie onto her lap and whisper to her that she wished her father was dead. Toward the end of her high school career, a particularly brutal outburst from her father had Annemarie fleeing her home. She went to live with a friend's family until she matriculated in 1991. In the same year that Annemarie matriculated, her father died in an accident at the mine he worked at. Her and her family's grief journey with her father's death was complicated. While they were sad that he died so tragically, they also felt a sense of relief that they no longer had to live with the man's abusive behaviour. After matriculating, Annemarie decided that she wanted to study to become a nurse, so she moved to a nursing school in Krugersdorp and began studying there and moved into a hostel at the hospital as well. Very soon after arriving at the hospital, Annemarie met a young man who was working as a security guard there. Jaco Engelbrecht was a very charismatic man, and his outgoing nature was in contrast to Annemarie's shyness. Annemarie would later say that she'd been amazed that Jaco was interested in her, because she felt very unattractive at that time. Jaco and Annemarie became friendly and started going out together. She soon realized that his family background had been quite similar to hers. She felt as though this connection was important. If Jaco had also experienced an abusive home, He would surely be as determined as her not to repeat that in their own lives and the family they might build together. After 2 years of dating, Anna-Marie and Yaku got married. They moved into their own flat, and Anna-Marie was working and studying at the same time. Her career as a nurse was incredibly important to her. Yaku, though, started to experience some difficulties in his work life. He was fired from his job as a security guard at the hospital after he was involved in the theft of a television. Anna-Marie stood by him, but he didn't seem very motivated to find a new job, and instead sat at home while Anna-Marie worked as many shifts as she could to ensure they could pay their rent and other expenses. The first 3 years or so of the Engelbrechts' marriage were apparently very happy, and Anna-Marie said that she'd felt she'd really found the perfect man for her. With Yaku being unemployed, though, his attitude toward Anna-Marie started to change. He began drinking heavily and developed a pornography addiction. By 1997, Anna-Marie was feeling very insecure in her relationship. Although she would not have the language for it at the time, Yaku had started to become emotionally and financially abusive toward her, and incredibly controlling. It was not long until that abuse shifted to physical harm as well. Then, Yaku decided that it was time for them to start a family. Anna-Marie was not on the same page. She told Yaku in no uncertain terms that she did not think it was a good time to have children. They were struggling financially, and Anna-Marie wanted to make more progress in her studies and career before she became a mother. Although these were the two reasons she gave her husband for not wanting to get pregnant just yet, there were additional reasons. Yaku was becoming more and more abusive, and Anna-Marie was unsure that she wanted to stay in the marriage. She hoped that if Yaku got a full-time job and had something to focus his energy on rather than alcohol and pornography, things would go back to how they were in the beginning of their marriage. But Yaku seemed unwilling to go back into permanent employment again, and their troubles were viciously circling. In response to Anna-Marie's concerns and clear statement that she did not want to get pregnant, Yaku ramped up his abuse to another area of their life. He began tampering with her contraception. At the time, Anna-Marie would not have described what happened next as rape, but it most certainly was, and she would later acknowledge that. Anna-Marie said she often had sex with Yaku under coercion. He seemed to be sexually aroused by their arguments, and even though she would say that she didn't want to have sex until they'd resolved whatever the issue was at that time, Yaku would insist. And on the occasion that Anna-Marie fell pregnant with their daughter, he had used force as well. Then he stood over her and insisted she lay with her legs in the air for half an hour and told her not to use the toilet until he said it was okay. He was doing everything he could think of to impregnate her. In the episode of Heiskenoot Vare Levensdramas, domestic violence expert and forensic psychologist Dr. Gerard Labiskagni explains that this is a common part of the abuse cycle. Abusive partners, whether on purpose or not, will encourage their victim to become pregnant as a means of control. Having children makes it far more difficult to leave the relationship, and it means they'll have more ways to control their partner. In a sad irony, after the child is born, this is often when the abuse will increase. Abusive partners often don't like the fact that their spouse's attention is now being split between them and the new baby. And even though they may have encouraged, or even, as Anna-Marie alleges, forced the pregnancy, they become jealous of the child. When their daughter was born in 1998, Anna-Marie tried to push aside all of her trepidation about what this would mean for her life. Above all, She wanted to ensure that her child did not have the same traumatic and abusive childhood that she had experienced. For a few months after their daughter's birth, Yaku was far less abusive than he had been before. But everything quickly went back to their own horrific version of normal, Anna-Marie says. But now she had a child, and she found herself far braver and more willing to stand up against Yaku's abuse. Over the next few years, Anna-Marie started to try to get help from authorities. When Yaku would assault her, she would phone police begging for help. On most occasions, the police simply did not arrive. On the odd occasion that they did, and she was able to lay charges, the process would be so long and drawn out that she would get sucked into the very common cycle of being convinced by Yaku to withdraw the charges. After that happened a couple of times, police would then use that to defend why they were not responding to her pleas for help. One police officer was on record telling Anna-Marie, "You people do this. You lay charges and then you withdraw them, and you just waste our time. So now, this problem is yours." The "you people" the officer is on record referring to here is, of course, abused women. Although this was in the late 90s, early 2000s, and I do recognise that education around domestic violence and coercive control has improved since then, and that is clear in our convictions, the level of ignorance in that statement is honestly wild. Yes, victims of domestic violence are known to retract charges. But that's not because the abuse never happened. Rather, that is a big red flag that the victim is headed down a deadly road of coercion, which will often end in their death. Anna-Marie soon started to realize that in order to successfully and safely see through criminal charges and ultimately a divorce, she was going to need a way to keep Yaku away from her while the process played out. So she began to attempt to get restraining orders and domestic violence interdicts against him. After a stressful process of trying to figure out exactly what she was supposed to do to achieve this, including one recorded phone call with police, during which the officer just kept repeating that the SAPS didn't do restraining orders. Eventually, after Anna-Marie asked numerous times where she could go for help, she was told to go to the court. And that was it. But the courts were not particularly helpful with this either. Anna-Marie attempted to get an interdict against Yaku on 3 or 4 occasions. None of these attempts were successful. In some cases, the paperwork was lost, or the process took so long that Anna-Marie didn't pursue it. But on at least 2 occasions, the magistrates accused Anna-Marie of lying and refused the orders. One police officer even suggested that Yaku take out protection orders against Anna-Marie. Anna-Marie's experiences with police weren't all bad, though. There was one police officer from Krugersdorp Police Station who had believed her and had given her his cell phone number to call if she was afraid. But the officer could only do so much on his own. And Yaku's coercion, stalking and harassment of Anna-Marie continued almost unabated. Anna-Marie's interactions with the police were not constant. As is the normal cycle of abuse, once Yaku had assaulted Anna-Marie and he saw that she was going to take action, he would apologize, love bomb her, and then slowly escalate back to the same level of situation. His controlling behaviors of her went further and further. He confiscated her cell phone and accused her of cheating. She was only allowed to leave the house to go to work, and she had to hand over her salary to him to control. He spent huge amounts of money on alcohol and pornography. On one occasion, she'd gone to a co-worker's bachelorette party with Yaku's consent. But when she returned, he'd suddenly become enraged and insisted that she'd been with another man. He ripped her clothes off and inspected her genitals for signs of sexual activity. After one particularly violent night in 2001, Anna Marie had gone to work with a black eye. She tried to cover it up with makeup, as she'd done so many times before, but her supervisor called her aside and told her that she couldn't see patients in such a condition. They sent her home. That night, though, the hospital experienced an uncharacteristic surge in patients, and they needed all hands on deck, so they called her back in. Yaku hadn't believed her and had attempted to strangle her. After Anna Marie had gotten away from him, she'd still gone to work. She was terrified that she would lose her job, which was her only means of independence and the only way out for her and her daughter. But when she returned home from work that night, she found the house empty. Both Yaku and their daughter were nowhere to be found. Terrified that Yaku had done something to her child, Anna Marie called the police officer who'd been helpful to her in the past. He spent a few minutes phoning around and located Yaku at the hospital. Their daughter had apparently had an inner ear infection, and she'd been crying so much Yaku didn't know what to do, so he'd taken her in. At the hospital, the doctors had wanted to admit the child because she had a very high fever. But Yaku, who was very intoxicated, refused to let them do so and became aggressive. Police had been called, and Yaku was arrested. With Yaku in jail, albeit only for a short period, Anna Marie saw her chance to escape, and she took it. As soon as her daughter was discharged from the hospital, she fled with the child. She needed to stay in the area because her daughter went to school there and her work was there. But she went to a lot of trouble to find a flat that she hoped Yaku wouldn't locate. As soon as he was out of jail, though, he did find her, and his campaign of stalking, harassment, and abuse continued. Only now, she had the added shame of neighbours and landlords being involved. Over the next few months, Anna Marie moved, and then moved again, when Yaku tracked her down yet again. She had started divorce proceedings, but all told, she would have to move 9 times in just a few months to try and get away from him. Finally, exhausted and once again being love-bombed, Anna Marie returned to live with her husband. Anna Marie said she felt as though she had no way out. She realized that her daughter was experiencing exactly what she had as a child. And even though the child was not being assaulted by Yaku, he was becoming emotionally and verbally abusive toward her. With Yaku still not working, the child was looked after by him when Anna Marie was at work. On more than one occasion, Anna Marie became aware that the child had been exposed to the pornography her father watched so often. When victims are abused and stalked to the extent that Anna Marie was, they often start to believe that their abuser almost has some sort of superpowers. She'd moved 9 times and done everything she could to ensure he didn't know where she was, but he always seemed to find her. She realized that if she wanted to get away from Yaku, she would have to leave her job, pull her daughter out of school, and probably move across the country. But Yaku still had parental rights, and he could get the police to track her down on his behalf. She also didn't have the resources to restart her life somewhere else. Yaku was using every cent she made. It seemed like a completely hopeless situation. And Anna Marie began to better understand the situation her own mother had found herself in all those years before. Her mom's only way out had eventually been the death of her father. His death in an accident had freed everyone. And now, she perhaps began to wonder if that would be her only way out too. She had regularly told police officers that she believed Yaku was going to end up killing her. Was it going to be a matter of either her death or his that eventually made the abuse come to an end? What happened on the day of Yaku's death would be put together from testimony from Anna-Marie, their daughter, store owners who had seen Yaku and Anna-Marie, and friends of Anna-Marie, who would later become involved. On Saturday the 29th of June 2002, Anna-Marie had a shift at the hospital. She left her daughter and Yaku sleeping when she left. When Yaku woke up, he told his daughter to get dressed, and he walked with her to a shop nearby that sold sex toys, paraphernalia, and porn movies. He left his daughter standing outside the store while he went inside and purchased several items, including porn movies. Yaku also ordered a few items from the catalogue, and the store owner told him that they would be ready for collection later that afternoon. He then went home with his daughter, and from what police could later ascertain, he spent most of the rest of the day watching the porn movies he'd purchased in the lounge, while his daughter walked in and out of the room. During the day, Yaku phoned Anna-Marie at work and instructed her to stop by the sex shop on her way home from work and collect and pay for the items he'd ordered. Anna-Marie did as he asked, and she also purchased some meats that they could braai for dinner later that night. When she got home, she found Yaku still watching porn, and she was enraged to find their daughter walking in and out of the lounge with the adult content on the television in full view. She asked Yaku to switch off the television. He said that was fine, because he wanted to try out some of the things he'd seen in the movies anyway. He took Anna-Marie into the bedroom, made her get undressed, and gave her instructions about what he wanted her to do. Anna-Marie said that Yaku was already heavily intoxicated, and she was afraid to say no, so she'd done what he'd asked. At one point, their daughter had walked into the room and her husband had screamed at her to get out. When Yaku was finished, he'd poured another drink, and he and Anna-Marie had sat on the couch in the lounge. As Anna-Marie's daughter played with her mother's hair, she dropped a hair clip on the floor and bent down to pick it up. When she sat back up, she accidentally elbowed her father in the face. Yaku had erupted and screamed at the child, beating her until Anna-Marie intervened and the girl ran to her bedroom. Anna-Marie tried to go after her daughter, but she said Yaku wouldn't let her. This was not uncommon, and she said Yaku would regularly refuse to allow Anna-Marie to comfort the child after one of his outbursts. This time, though, Anna-Marie said she saw red and didn't care about the consequences for herself as she heard her daughter sobbing in the next room. She stood up to Yaku and told him she was going to her daughter. He threatened to kill her if she did. But she swore at him and told him to do what he wanted to do, but she was going to her child. As the evening wore on, things seemed to calm down, although Yaku was still being antagonistic and swearing at both Anna-Marie and their daughter. But he bribed the meats Anna-Marie had bought, and the family ate dinner. After their daughter had gone to bed, Yaku took two sleeping tablets and told Anna-Marie that it was time for them to go to sleep too. She complied, tired from a full day of work and her husband's poor behaviour, and she'd gotten into bed beside Yaku. He was soon drifting off to sleep as the sleeping tablets hit him, but in the in-between parts of his sleep, where he was still half asleep and half awake, Anna-Marie said that he began groping her. She lay very still, hoping he would just fall asleep. But eventually she couldn't take it anymore and got up and left the bedroom. She'd sat in the lounge, having a cigarette and a drink. Initially, she just wanted to give Yaku enough time to fully fall asleep, and then she intended to go to sleep herself. But as she sat there in the dark, she started to think about something else. Anna Marie had come to the conclusion that her only way out of the situation she found herself in was for Yaku to die. At the sex shop earlier that day, she'd picked up something additional to what Yaku had ordered. Thumb cuffs. Exactly like handcuffs, thumb cuffs can be used to restrain people, but they only fasten over the thumb rather than the wrist. Anna Marie picked the thumb cuffs up off the counter and also picked up a plastic bag that contained the meats that they'd eaten earlier. She went into the bedroom where she found her husband fast asleep, the sleeping tablets now having taken full hold. Anna Marie rolled her husband onto his side and cuffed his thumbs behind his back. Then she placed the plastic bag over his head and removed the belt from her dressing gown. She wound the material belt around Yaku's neck and over the plastic bag, holding it in place. She watched for a moment as her husband's breath began to fog up the bag and the small amount of air inside it disappeared, and the plastic began to suck toward his face with each breath he took. After double-checking that the thumb cuffs were secure, she left the room and sat in the lounge. She would later say that she knew if she'd stayed in the room, she would have changed her mind and removed the bag, and she couldn't allow that to happen. She fully believed, she said, that this was the only way to save herself and her daughter from the horrific life Yaku had inflicted upon them. Although a pathologist later said it would have taken just 3 to 5 minutes for Yaku to suffocate and his heart to stop beating, Anna Marie stayed in the lounge for about half an hour. Then, once she was sure he was dead, she'd called two of her friends to her home. The friends had known all about Yaku's abuse of her, and she had even lived with them at one point until Yaku had started to target them. The friends were, of course, horrified to discover that Yaku was dead, and when Anna Marie asked for help in moving his body, one of the friends immediately refused, and the other went along with that. Although they could perhaps understand what may have led to Yaku's murder, having once been targets of his hatred and obsession themselves, they didn't want to get involved in helping Anna Marie to hide her crime. The friends left. It appeared that Anna Marie had wanted to move Yaku's body to a completely different location, where he would be discovered and his murder may be blamed on a random stranger murder. When the friends left, Anna Marie continued to move his body. It was the early hours of the morning, and the block of flats was quiet. She'd managed to get his body to the ground floor and was trying to head for her car when the parking lot of the block of flats lit up with blue lights and sirens. Her friends, terrified that they would get into trouble for being involved somehow in Yaku's murder, had gone straight to the police station from her flat and reported what they'd seen. Although Anna Marie initially claimed that her husband had been out drinking and she'd found him dead outside their door, she'd panicked and tried to hide his body, she didn't stick with that story for very long. And she soon admitted that, yes, she had killed her husband. She was arrested and charged with Yaku's murder. Later in court, a very different story would emerge of exactly what had happened between the three friends that night. But it would be quite some time before Anna Marie's trial actually started. She was held in prison for 18 months before court proceedings began. She initially said that she was going to plead guilty, but after a legal team change, her new lawyers seemed to see her case differently. And ultimately, Anna Marie entered a plea of not guilty. When her trial began, she was released on bail for the duration of the trial. To understand how this trial played out and the defence Anna Marie hoped to use, and also how this applies to other abused individuals, it's necessary to understand the legal components of a murder conviction and the relevant defences. In South Africa, the general definition of murder is the unlawful and intentional killing of another person. The unlawful element stems from the fact that human life, as defined in our constitution, is protected in South African law, and any removal of the right to life of a legally defined human being is illegal. The components that need to be considered in considering whether a death was legally a murder are, firstly, criminal capacity. In other words, is the individual old enough and of the level of intellect and psychological capacity to be prosecuted? Secondly, was the conduct voluntary? And thirdly, was there intent to cause death? A prosecutor must therefore prove these elements: that the accused killing of the individual was both unlawful and intentional, and that they had criminal capacity, their conduct was voluntary, and their intention was to cause death. In Anna Marie's case, although she claimed that she had intended to kill her husband, an argument still existed that due to the abuse she'd suffered, her ability to form legal intent may have been impaired. This would not necessarily make her not guilty, because from a legal perspective, Anna Marie still knew it was legally not right to kill her husband, but it could provide significant mitigation. But if Anna Marie could prove that the killing of Yaku did not fully meet the criteria of unlawfulness, that could essentially make her not guilty of murder. Criminal capacity is determined, among other ways, through the psychological assessment that occurs prior to a trial beginning. Anna Marie was found not to be suffering from any mental health condition that would have impaired her to the extent of not having capacity on that day. But again, that didn't mean that the condition of her mental health could not be used as a defense in other ways, or at least a significant mitigation. There are four defenses available to someone like Anna Marie, who kills someone they claim has been abusive to them. The first is a private defense, also known as self-defense. This is a defense against the unlawfulness elements of murder, in that the individual is saying that their life was in danger, and this is why they had to take the life of the other person. There are several elements that make this defense successful, but the most important one in this context becomes a requirement and an interpretation of imminence. For self-defense to be, well, self-defense, you have to prove that the threat on the self was imminent. For the most part, imminent in a courtroom is defined as happening right now. But it is open to interpretation to an extent. The second form of defense is a putative private defense, which relies on the prospect that the accused had enough reason to believe that their life was in imminent risk, even though later evidence showed it was not. An example of this could be an attacker using a toy gun that looks very real, and that attacker being shot by the person they were pretending to hold at gunpoint. The third possible defense is that of pathological incapacity, which would colloquially be referred to as the insanity defense, and requires that the individual have been so mentally ill at the time of their crime that they cannot be held liable for their actions. And the fourth defense is called non-pathological incapacity, or sane automatism, or a defense of emotional stress and provocation. This involves the accused having been almost temporarily incapable of forming voluntary action due to significant emotional stress or provocation. The defense that Anna Marie put forth was that she had acted in self-defense, and the challenge for the defense would be to prove that, as an abused individual, in her mind, the threat was constantly imminent. When the prosecution presented its case, it tried to explain the abusive behavior of Jaco Engelbrecht, referring to him as having lost his job, the difficulties this must have caused him, claiming that he was a victim of spurious charges and attempts at interdicts from his wife, and that Anna Marie had used their child as a pawn to control Jaco. For the most part, in cross-examination, these claims were proven baseless by the defense. Although in many cases there's often nothing more than the victim's own testimony about alleged abuse, in this case there was actually significant proof and testimony from countless witnesses, including staff at the hospitals where Anna Marie had worked, the couple's friends, landlords and police officers, that confirmed that Jaco had abused, stalked and harassed Anna Marie. The main issue in the trial was that the defense found it difficult to explain why Anna Marie had seemed quite calculated in her acts at the time. This became more of a problem when the two friends who'd been at her flat that night took the stand. The two women testified that the night of Jaco's death was not the first time their friend Anna Marie had asked for help around her husband and murder. Although in cross-examination, Anna Marie's defense attorney would deny all of this, the two women claimed that in the weeks before Jaco's death, Anna Marie had approached them to help her kill her husband. The pair claimed that they said they didn't know anyone who could kill someone. Then Anna Marie asked if they could just get her a gun and she would do it herself. They claimed they'd said that they'd see what they could do, and she'd given them 300 rand to buy a gun for her. Both women claimed Anna Marie had called them several times over the weeks that followed, asking how far they were with the gun. They'd given excuses, and then on the evening of Jaco's murder, she had called them to come and help her. The two women had claimed that when they'd arrived, Jaco was still in the bed, and he'd still had the thumb cuffs on and the bag over his head. One woman said that Anna Marie had asked her to double-check that Jaco was dead, and she'd done so and found he had no pulse. The women said that they'd helped to remove the thumb cuffs from Jaco's hands, which they said were actually very loosely applied, and they'd figured that the man mustn't have regained consciousness at any point because he probably could have loosened his hands if he had. They'd apparently removed the bag too and helped to put Jaco's body onto a duvet and pull him off the bed. Anna Marie had apparently given them Jaco's cell phone and told them to throw the SIM card out. But the women had decided not to help any further and they'd left and driven to the police station to report what had happened. The two women had different stories about what they believed the motivation for Jaco's murder was. Both did say that they knew Anna Marie and her daughter were being constantly abused, and this was the main reason she wanted her husband dead, as she tried to escape before, but she'd failed. But one of the women added that Anna Marie had mentioned Jaco had a pension fund from one of his previous jobs that would pay out if he died. It was also alleged that in addition to shooting him to death, Anna Marie had also suggested a plan to inject her husband's hamburger with insulin, which would kill him. Both the defense and the prosecution presented their cases to the court, with the prosecution acknowledging that although they did see the abuse had been present, they were not certain it was as insurmountable as Anna Marie had claimed. And as it concerned her selected defense of private defense, they did not feel that the situation met the requirements of that defense because there were other options available to her and they didn't feel the threat was imminent. In more complex trials, A judge will have two assessors appointed to assist them in their decision. The assessors are usually people who are well-versed in the law, in their careers such as advocates or magistrates, and they're ordinarily retired and can dedicate large amounts of time to a trial and be available when necessary. When assessors are assigned to a trial, they will assess the evidence themselves, and each will get a vote toward a guilty or not guilty verdict. So, such trials are decided by a majority verdict between the two assessors and the judge. It's essentially like a mini jury, except not made up of members of the public, but rather of individuals who are well-versed in the law. It's an excellent safeguard for justice in South African cases. Anna Marie's trial did have two assessors, because already at the start it was clear that this was not going to be a cut-and-dry case. When judgments started to be handed down in Anna Marie's case, it became clear that Judge Satchwell and the assessors had not agreed on their final decisions. As such, Satchwell delivered her judgment, highlighting those areas in which her and the assessors had not agreed, but also affirming the final verdict that had been handed down. In her judgment, Judge Satchwell made certain statements that would go down in legal history as incredibly meaningful. The interpretation of imminence was, of course, an important part of this case. Was the threat on Anna Marie's life imminent? And how did the court intend to interpret imminence? It also became clear that there was a distinct difference between how the assessors and the judge had interpreted that imminent threat. Judge Satchwell said, quote, "Once there has been a single assault, the fabric of a relationship changes irrevocably. It is thereafter possible that the violence may be repeated with equivalent or greater levels of injury," end quote. Satchwell said that in her opinion, the threat of violence from Yaku toward Anna Marie was always imminent, in that it had occurred over and over again throughout the years, and the repeated pattern made it not only imminent in Anna Marie's mind, but also inevitable. The general test in such cases is, what would the reasonable person do in such an instance? And could Anna Marie's situation be paired up with the reasonable person character when she was under constant threat and experience of abuse? The assessors in the case found that despite the evidence of police and judicial failings, Anna Marie had not given society sufficient opportunity to assist her in escaping her situation, and that her actions did not constitute the reasonable person's actions. Judge Satchwell, on the other hand, determined that Anna Marie's actions were entirely reasonable, given Yaku's ongoing and sustained violence toward her and her child, and she'd been let down time and again when she'd reached out for help. Ultimately, in a very rare occurrence, the judgments in this case came down to the assessors overruling the judge, and Anna Marie was found guilty of the murder of her husband. When assessors are involved in a case, their involvement ends at the judgment phase. So it would be up to Judge Satchwell to pass down a sentence she found fitting. Interestingly, despite their strong position that Anna Marie had been guilty of murder and did not have any valid defense, the prosecution didn't request jail time in their sentencing request. Instead, they requested that Anna Marie be given a community service sentence. In 2005, 3 years after Yaku Engelbrecht was murdered, Judge Satchwell was ready to hand down her sentence. From the start, it became clear that although she'd been overridden in judgment, her sentencing would now reflect her legal view of the case against Anna Marie Engelbrecht. The judge detailed some of the instances of abuse that had been placed before her as evidence. She said outright that she did not see that prison time would be a just sentence for the crime. And in addressing the prosecution's request for community service, she said that Anna Marie already worked as a nurse, so in essence, she was already serving the community. In addition, Satchwell said that in her legal view, Anna Marie had already served a sentence inside of her marriage, saying that no one else will likely ever truly understand the suffering Anna Marie had endured during the 9 years she was married to Jaco Engelbrecht. She remarked that it was clear to her that Anna Marie's actions on the day of the murder were not those of a voluntary choice, but rather she had, quote, programmed herself to kill her husband, despite not really wanting to, as she saw it as the only way out of her situation. Then, in a sentencing that had never been seen in a South African court before, Judge Satchwell sentenced Anna Marie to be detained until the rising of the court. For a few moments, a strange silence fell over the courtroom, as those present tried to comprehend what exactly was happening. Judge Satchwell remained seated for another 5 minutes before standing and declaring, "Mrs. Engelbrecht, you have served your sentence. You are free to go." Anna Marie Engelbrecht had been sentenced to 5 minutes incarceration. The court erupted. Jaco's brother and his sister-in-law, who'd been present, were livid and told journalists outside the court that they were speechless at the sentence. Anna Marie sobbed in the arms of her supporters and told journalists that she just wanted to get home and be with her daughter. Although in her sentencing remarks, Satchwell had put on record that she did not want other abused individuals to see her ruling as a permission slip to kill their abusers, Jaco's family and some others were concerned that this would be the case. There hasn't been another case identical to Anna Marie's, though, since then, and so it doesn't appear that the sentence set a negative precedent. I will say that I can fully understand Jaco's family's viewpoint. Their loved one was murdered, and they hoped to see a stronger sentence against the person who took his life. The family never denied outright that Jaco had abused Anna Marie, but did say that he had been a wonderful and loving father. It is not uncommon for the family of an abusive person to not fully see the extent of their loved one's behavior. In fact, most people outside of the relationship will see the abuser as the abuser portrays themselves 90% of the time, as a loving and caring and gentle partner. In researching this case, I did come across several academic studies regarding this and similar cases in South Africa, in which legal academics argued that the Engelbrecht case should have become a turning point for common law in the country, in which we recognize that the lived experience of an abused person, especially a woman, is not adequately reflected in the defenses available to them. These studies question whether the so-called battered woman defense needs to be adapted to include the socioeconomic and specific conditions of the country we live in, considering how little support abuse victims get from police and the judiciary. In addition, there is the fact that levels of gender-based and intimate partner violence and rape are so high in South Africa that this alone adds to the level of imminence of threat that women may experience in an abusive relationship. Although today, 2 decades later, we are sadly still seeing cases in which victims of abuse are failed by the system, which more often than not results in their death and not that of their abuser, there have been small positive changes made since the Engelbrecht case occurred. As I've mentioned in other episodes regarding intimate partner violence, it's very clear that today judges are far better educated around the issues of domestic violence, intimate partner violence, and coercive control. One of these changes has been quite recent and addresses the matter of victims of abuse withdrawing charges, often under coercion from their abusers. In April 2023, amendments were written into law for the Domestic Violence Act, which, among others, institutes an important change. The amended Act now introduces safeguards against the easy dismissal of charges, hoping to ensure that justice is served and that victims are not further jeopardized. Complainants must now provide the court with clear and convincing reasons for wanting to withdraw charges. This could include evidence of reconciliation, access to adequate support services, or a clearly reduced risk of future violence. The amended Act also empowers the state prosecutor to continue pursuing the case, even if the complainant withdraws charges. And while this, along with other changes in the Act, are important, it's also vital that these changes are paired with stronger support from the SAPS to protect victims, because pushing on with charges places victims in a very precarious position. We are certainly also seeing sentences better reflecting the severity of abusive partners killing their victims. But it's difficult to say how much difference there is in cases where the accused is claiming they were victims of abuse, which led them to murder the deceased. For the most part, these cases are addressed on an individual basis, which is perhaps the most fair option at this point. I must say that some of the arguments I read about the importance of creating specific legal defences, which include considerations for things like coercive control and ongoing abuse, do hold some muster in my mind. It's incredibly complex, though, because there's also a point where you have to wonder whether you are creating laws to protect victims or to protect murderers. In most of the similar cases I looked at, there was little evidence other than the victim's own testimony that abuse had occurred. And there were many pieces of evidence that seemed to show that if there had been abuse, it didn't play a major role in the murder, and rather the motive ended up being something else entirely. It truly is complex. And in trying to consider my opinion on cases like this, I always try to ask, how would I feel if the accused was male and the victim was female? Of course, that's a difficult comparison because of all the added societal and socioeconomic stuff that comes along with being a woman. Either way, I think it's fair to say that no one deserves to get murdered, regardless of what they've done. But it's also not as simple as that. If a parent caught a paedophile raping their child and killed them, I have no doubts that the large majority of people would be supportive of that action. You might say, I would do the same. A child is vulnerable. Now we have to decide what our definition of vulnerable is, I guess. Does that extend to a victim of a decade of abuse, conditioning, and control? Or does that vulnerability end simply by virtue of age? Another thing that really concerned me about this case is that Anna Marie was a nurse. She was surrounded by other health professionals for most of her adult life. They saw the bruises and other injuries, and they knew bits and pieces, if not the entire story of her life at home. And I won't say no one tried to help her, because maybe they did. We have no idea. But it was very evident that Anna Marie had no idea how to even get a restraining order. Surely individuals within health professions should be able to guide you to resources if you are a clear victim of abuse. Anna Marie Engelbrecht was found guilty of murder. Many agree with her sentence. Many don't. I was Unfortunately, not able to find out more about her life after the trial, but I did see that one of her lifelong friends commented on a social media post saying that Anna Marie had passed away in 2023. I have no idea whether she lived a happy and peaceful life after her husband's murder or if she continued to struggle. Her case will forever mark South African legal history, though, and continues to be used as a reference in similar cases. Really, the ideal would be that no one ever finds themselves in a position again where they have to choose between their life or the life of another. The absolutely perfect scenario would be that no one could ever use this as a legal defense, because the system works so seamlessly and is so empowered to support victims that from that first moment of violence, as Judge Satchwell said, which irrevocably alters the fabric of a relationship, there are multiple safe and accessible ways out. That would be a perfect world. But until then, we may be continuously presented with these complex cases where death feels like the only way out. But civil society has no choice but to call it murder. Jaco Engelbrecht, Anna Marie Engelbrecht, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.